holy f- I don't care if you're in games or not, this is a brilliant idea. Our buddy developed this thing, which is genius, and I really hope he's still doing this, because he definitely still makes games. But he developed this concept called Poo Naps, and basically, the gist of it is, you're in the shitter for so long that your legs fall asleep. So
remember, this is the days before smartphones, too.
That's true. Yeah. So there's no, like, I'm sitting there playing Crash Royale for like 35 minutes and my legs fall asleep and I'm like, oh God. And then like waddle like a duck who's just given birth to 20 ducklings down the hall. So this guy, ahead of his time, obviously brilliant, he develops this philosophy. He says like, look, I'm going to go in and take a shit. I'm going to chill out and it's going to be my Zen time. Like, I'm going to let it go. And then I'm just going to kind of let myself take a little nap. And I'll wake up when I wake up. And here's the thing. Nobody's going to bother me. Right? I know this is a safe space for me. And I can get a couple things done. Right? I can get the poo out and get a nap in. You know, he needed his little midday poo nap.
Welcome to the D3 Podcast, Drunk Developer Diaries. We're at the bar, we've got some beers in front of us, so pull up a stool and listen in as we talk to video game professionals about how games are made, how you might be able to get in the industry if you should be so inclined, and get a little bit of their history along the way. I'm your host, Ryan Woodland.
And I'm your co-host, Jeremy Morrison. Ryan, it has been a while. I've not seen you in a hot minute. What have you been up to?
Ugh, God, I was down in Austin yesterday working on some game stuff. You know, pretty much just making games work.
Amazing. I'm cracking open a beer. And full disclosure, this is not going to be my first beer for the night. Speaking of disclosure, we got some housekeeping to get out of the way. The views and opinions expressed on the D3 podcast by its hosts and guests do not represent the opinions of any entity whatsoever with which its hosts or guests are now or will be affiliated with. Specific information and personal details may be omitted from recordings after the fact, to protect the identity and reputation of those discussed. The lawyers just handed me that, so you know. I hope it said it right.
Sounds official.
Yeah. Also, we got a new website, d3podcast.com, so check that out. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at the D3 Podcast. We're on Instagram as well. And that's about it. And this is episode 2. I'm excited. Ryan, who is our guest tonight?
So tonight on the podcast, we have Ben Jones.
Hi.
How's it going, Ben?
Good. Oh, yeah.
There you go. There
yeah. All right, now we're hyped up. Hi. Hi, I'm here.
So, hey, so Ben is a game designer and creative director that I've known for a very long time. He's been at some of the biggies in the industry, EA and Valve and Sony, and worked on some huge franchises like Battlefield. Let's see, you're on SOCOM, you're on Medal of Honor. So lots of experience. But the most important question, since this is Drunk Developer Diaries, what are you drinking tonight?
In front of me, I have a Natty Bow, which is a local varietal. It's
National
delicious.
Bohemian.
Yes, if you're not familiar, here in the Baltimore area, this is how the quote unquote locals do. Although apparently there's some controversy regarding Natty Bow that we won't get into because
you mean whether or not it's actually local or not,
right? Yeah, some people say it is, some people don't. I don't know. I'm not local, so I just drink it. It's delicious.
It's delicious.
It's kind of the Baltimore equivalent of like a
PBR.
Lone Star or Rainier or an Old Style.
Yes.
And we have a bottle of Jameson in front of us, so we'll be getting to that. I should give the disclaimer that Ben is working on super secret stuff right now, so we can't actually talk about where he is now.
Can we use code names?
I don't know. We can make them up.
Yeah, just made up code.
Calamity.
He's working on Calamity. So we can't get into that, but as we like to do on the podcast, let's get into some history and we'll kind of talk about it along the way. So starting out, where are you from? How did this all start?
So in 1776, so I've been in the industry, man, in and out for maybe 20 years, depending on perspective, professionally for at least 15. I got my start a long, long time ago. I was very fortunate in high school to kind of pick up amateur development.
Where was this? You're from Texas,
yeah,
right?
So I grew up in Dallas, and my folks were both in technology, so we always had computers at the house. I was always very engaged. I started playing on Apple IIs and Ataris and Commodores and all that stuff when I was really young.
Now, were you messing around with any kind of like coding at that time? Or
not when I was like seven. That was a little aggressive. I was messing around with like trying to dress myself cohesively. And
I see you've made some progress, but still not got that.
Thanks.
Down.
Yeah. You know, I'm wearing the same color. It's good. That'll progress really, really fast because I was always focused in computers and technology. That was what my folks did, and they brought me up to be really interested in that. And my dad and I would play games together. When he'd come home from work, we'd jump on like the Apple II GS or whatever and jump in and play all the games on floppy disk. And that was a thing, and I loved it. So by the time high school got around, I was super, super into all the amazing things that were happening in the first-person shooter world at that time. Obviously, there was a huge development community in Dallas, very focused on some properties you might know, like Doom and Duke Nukem, which I loved. So I kind of got into the scene when the tools for those games became more and more available. So I think the first tool set I picked up was for a game called Blood, which was a first-person shooter. And God, I'm struggling to remember the name of the developer and publisher for that. But it was a crazy, gory first-person shooter in the style of Duke Nukem, but way over the top with ridiculous, insane enemies. And I just loved it. And they opened up their developer kit for that so you could build different levels. So I started messing around with that. And around the same time, you know, maybe, let's see, a couple of years later, I guess, Half-Life came out and their developer tool set was released, their SDK, right? It was released to the public as well. And, you know, at the time, forms of communication were very primitive on the quote-unquote internet. And I remember we were using a thing called Merc, which was like Relay Chat. To communicate.
Oh, yeah, of course.
You know what I'm talking about? Uh-huh. Like you had all these different forums. It's weird because I feel like there are a lot of parallels to the way Discord is now, minus all the amazing features. But anyway, so, you know, potential developers and people who are interested in actually making games and contributing in any way would get together on IRC and talk about it. And that's kind of happened with the game that I got my first start on, which is called Day of Defeat. You know, a bunch of us got together with similar ideas and wanted to help each other in whatever way we could. And I didn't know much about development at the time, but I knew a lot about World War II. My family is French, so I spent a lot of time in France, and I had all these amazing photos that I thought we could for the game, right? So ended up making like texture packs, and that all evolved, and you know, ended up doing community stuff and marketing support and anything else I could contribute because we were a loose team that had never met each other ever. Right.
Now, was this while you were still in high school?
This was, that all happened when I was in high school, and then by the time I was in college, like my sophomore year of college, we had developed Day of Defeat to be this active thing. It had a big community. And I think in I don't have the numbers in front of me, but in terms of player population, we were right there with Counter-Strike and Team Fortress.
That's amazing.
Yeah, wow. it was a big deal in the late 90s, early 2000s, and it just kind of swept us up, brought up really, really talented people on that team. So,
how many people were on that team? How big was it?
There were about eight of us on the core team, and with a game like that, you can't even count the number of people that support you in innumerable ways, right? So lots of people helping out, but yeah, I'd say the core of us was about eight, and that was around the time that we got a call from Valve, and they're like, hey, we really like your game. You should come work for us. And that doesn't really seem real. Like a 21-year-old kid, right? You're like, yeah, cool, whatever that is. Like, oh, you want to pay me for video games? Yeah, fine, I guess. Because all of us were doing it out of passion. You know, it wasn't about a professional gig.
And that was really before the indie scene was even a thing.
Right. And I mean, if you remember, you know, there were prior to that, and there are probably some other mod acquisitions that I can't speak of, but the ones that happened at Valve that I know of for sure were the other two I referenced, Team Fortress and Counter-Strike, were the only things to really reference there. And that, you know, that certainly wasn't a standard within the industry. It wasn't like now where it's like, oh, you created this cool mod that's like a battle royale thing. Oh, cool, we'll license that to now come work for us. Right. And, you know what I mean? Like I mean, it's not that it's standard now either, but then it was relatively unheard of. So none of us expected that to happen. We were just having fun and enjoying the fact that we were making something we all believed in and thought was really fun.
So let me ask you, because you did go to college, and this is one thing I find fascinating.
I went to school.
Yeah, I know. You're one of them. But I found this fascinating because you're I think, the first person I ever knew who had a game development degree from a major school, and you actually did it before there was
How
a game development degree.
Yeah, so really interesting. And it's funny enough now because, we're in the process of trying to hire people, and some of the students that we're looking at are kids from this grad school that I went to. So to walk it all the way back, after I left Valve and went back to school to finish my degree, I graduated. I changed majors from business because I was like, oh, that sucks. When I got back, I'm like, I got a taste of video games. I'm like, why the hell would I do this? Accounting's for losers,
right?
I came back and I was like, all right, well, I'm going to do something I'm passionate about. So I changed my major to film and television. And I'm like, this was amazing. Great. And, you know, graduated or whatever. And then I got out and I'm like, I don't know what to do. Because just like video games, like getting a job in film and television isn't just like, oh, hey, here's my resume. Right. Hire me.
It's like, just all who you know.
Yeah. Exactly. And I knew nobody. I got out and I had no idea. And, you know, I had been doing some consulting for this startup in Dallas called the Guildhall, which was pretty much the first of its kind, although Full Sail had been established before, but more as a digital media, digital arts college.
And Digipen was around.
And Digipen was around too, but they were more focused on engineering and art.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Guildhall was one of the first programs that really had a focus in game design. I was skeptical at first, but I was doing consulting with them and I'm like, okay, this is cool. If this works, it'll be great. And this was around the time I graduated and I saw, the first one or two classes go through and get great jobs. And, I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I'd gotten a taste of video game development. Mm-hmm. I'm like, this is fascinating. Like, if I could do this for a living, it'd be really, really cool. I just don't know how to do it. Right. And I didn't have like a one-to-one skill set to where, like, I could get hired in game development today, right? I had a decent understanding of things. And at the time, I was a serial player doing, like, community management, marketing, mm-hmm. some level design, anything I could do to help, right? Which isn't really a, like, great resume to the game industry. Like, I'll do it all with very limited understanding or skills. Like, here you go.
I'm not sure any of us came in any differently, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, which is a whole other subject entirely that we could spend hours on.
Right.
The game industry is really weird how people get into it. It's fascinating. But anyway, the school showed a really intriguing prospect mm-hmm. in terms of entry into the industry. And I looked at that and said, you know what? Like, I got nothing to lose. Why don't I just try it myself? I'm already in Dallas. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just down the road. Like, I'm already working for the school. Like, why don't I just go in and apply and see what happens? And I got in, and I did the program, and it was like 18 months. And after that, I got out and got picked up by Sony and got to work with you.
Yeah, that's right. That's actually where we met. But now, did they have a curriculum there, or did it sounded like you almost got to define your own stuff there? It was kind of free form.
So it's interesting. Like, I have the strangest path into this school. So I started as a consultant, right? And then I got a job there the next summer working as like doing recruitment and facilities. And then in so doing, I was talking with a lot of people who are developing the curriculum around game design, doing some consulting around that. But they had formed this loose curriculum around level design as the primary curriculum. There wasn't like a game design. It was mostly focused on level design. It's like your, not necessarily your major, but your focus. Mm-hmm. And there were some teachers there that knew their shit. Like one of my teachers had worked on Duke Nukem, actually, which is awesome, full circle.
Right, right.
But yeah, they definitely knew their stuff, but it was very much evolving. So they gave you this limited amount of structure where they said, okay, like make a 2D side scroller, go. Like, whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
Make a level in Unreal Tournament for 8-on-8 multiplayer. Go, right? And it was up to you to really determine your own scope and structure and define what you thought would be interesting and compelling, because ultimately those were the pieces that would end up on your resume, right? Mm-hmm. And enable you to potentially get a job. So there was some guidance there, but it was pretty loose.
Okay.
So you're really defining, you're like, okay, like, what do I need to do to get a job?
Right, right.
How many other students were part of that program?
So at any given time, man, I want to say that there were like 50? 50, 60? Oh, wow,
that big. Yeah, yeah, it's bigger than I thought it would have been.
So, I mean, and it was really interesting. By the time I was graduating, they developed this curriculum where in the final quarter, I guess, you would work with cross-discipline teams to build games.
Okay,
right?
Cool.
And you'd come together, and they'd split basically the entire student population in half and say, like, all right, you're on one team, you're on the other.
Oh, wow. And you had programmers and artists.
Yeah, so. You had programmers and producers.
Okay.
So you would all come together and try to build something. And so I thought that was really fascinating because the goal was to replicate your experience in the industry, right? You sit down, you define a project scope, you work with everybody there to make it happen mm-hmm. in a limited timetable. You know, there's no budget, obviously, but yeah, but your budget is time, right? Yeah. So you're time locked and it's like, all right, go do this thing and just see what you come up with. And mm-hmm. the challenge is to build the best game possible with the resources you have, which is ultimately what we do every day. That was a fascinating thing. So yeah, it evolved greatly. So I was in the fourth graduating class of the Guildhall.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know what number they're up to now, like 30 maybe. I mean,
yeah,
that,
it must be,
it's
geez.
Crazy. Cause they, I think they do like three a year. Yeah, but it's changed a lot. And I think, you know, it's interesting to think about getting into the industry and how that's changed. Not to say that we have a true pipeline now, but there are definitely some channels that you can take.
It's much more formalized than
absolutely.
It used to be.
Yeah.
It used to be. So, like you said, you got out of there and you went to Sony, so Zipper Studio in Seattle.
That's an interactive Zipper.
Zipper Interactive, that's right.
Listening.
And how did you get in there? What did you come out of Guildhall with that made Zipper hire you?
So... That's an interesting story. You'll have to ask Andy. No.
So a shout out to a mutual friend, Andy Bowden, who we will have on the podcast at some point. I think he's at turn 10 now.
That would be a very interesting interview. Anyway, so I came out of there with a solid resume and a portfolio that represented my skill set in mm-hmm. 3D and multiplayer development, which happened to coincide with the things that you guys were interested in doing at Zipper Interactive,
sure.
right? Like building a big multiplayer game. I think it helped tremendously that I had, the experience of working on Day of Defeat and at Valve to get some professional structure. That clearly stood out to Andy right away.
Right.
Whereas, like, I handed him my resume and he kind of looked at it. He's like, yeah, you ever built anything or whatever? I'm like, yeah, this little thing, Day of Defeat or whatever. He's like, oh, come right in. And I was like, oh, shit, that was really helpful. And I was super lucky. So just circling back to anyone who's actually interested in getting into the industry and is working on your own projects, it's super important. Like,
yeah.
And if there are, you know, if there are mods out there or there's anything that, and it doesn't have to be, you know, regarded at the time or famous or in the public eye, but if there's a project that you're passionate about and you want to work on, absolutely do that. Mm-hmm. Spend some of your time outside of whatever you do in your normal life to try to make that happen, because even if that individual project or game doesn't take off, it will help you in the long run to build a portfolio that's compelling. And because somebody will see it and be like, one, this person has initiative, that's great. And two, I have something substantive to actually look at mm-hmm. that they built.
I can't stress enough how important that is for all disciplines too. I mean, even if you're an engineer, you know, go home and work on algorithms, work on a graphics engine, work on a AI algorithm, whatever.
That sounds exhausting. I don't know what that is.
It's utterly terrible. Some people enjoy that.
Mm.
You came into Zipper Interactive as what, a level designer?
Yeah, just
I mean,
a
you designed a ton of different stuff though. You were on UI.
Well, so it was interesting. So I was fortunate enough to be like the first designer hired for the project. So it was like me, Andy, mm-hmm. Who's the creative director, and Ryan Ellis, who's at Bungie, and Charlie Stab. Like, random shout outs, like crazy. Like, we should do a whole show on like everybody that worked on Mag who's now doing insane
and
shit.
What they're doing.
Yeah, that's a whole other show. But there were very few of us, and it was before CJ, who became our lead level designer, even came on because he was working on SOCOM. So I was kind of left alone to just like, hey, here's this game concept, tinker with what level design might be for for this game.
Yeah, let me go into a little background there because I wanted to talk to you about this. I wanted to get into what level design is a little bit because I get this a lot from people who are either modding or people asking questions. Like we have a friend in common who says to me all the time, my 13-year-old son, you know, picked up a level editor and he made a level and I could play it and I don't understand what's so hard about it. Like, why do you guys need highly paid professionals if my 13-year-old son can do it? And I don't think he grasps the subtleties of all of it. So,
sure.
To back up just a little bit, so Mag, one of the titles we worked on together, was a 256-player online first-person shooter for PlayStation 3.
Right. I mean, you could call it an MMO FPS.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. It kind of was.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, that was the first game that had that scale.
Mm-hmm.
So it was 128v128.
Yep.
And we had just we worked on it for years, but it took us so long to get level design down for that. What a good level looked like.
Right.
What was fun. So. Talk a little bit about that, like what you went through in designing that, because I think ultimately we were discussing this earlier that I think we finally figured it out 8 weeks before he shipped the game and built all of the levels that shipped with the game in about that amount of time. That may be the wrong time frame, but it was pretty quick.
Yeah, I don't know about 8 weeks, probably a little bit longer, but a couple of months where, you know, we were tinkering around with things a lot, and, you know... The original concept was that amount of scale, right, with all these hard points and objectives that you went to, similar in style to like a battlefield, right, mm-hmm. where you have a large scale, like 1024x1024 map or something like that, and that's meters. And you've got a number of objectives in it, and it's just open, right? And, you know, you as a leader define what your objective is, and everybody moves through that progressively. So there wasn't a lot of structure around it originally in terms of level framework. The mm-hmm. structure was more around leadership and groups and everything, like managing people,
right,
which
right.
With that amount of people is obviously a huge component, right? So I'm glad we were thinking about those things first. But the level design process was super organic. So it went from this kind of open construct of like do anything wherever you want.
Right.
You have these ultimate goals, but how you achieve them is up to you, to a way more structured, semi-linear focus, right? Where it was like, all right, you start with the battle lines and you have to take out these bunkers, and then like you want to take out their secondary defenses, like take out their anti-aircraft and that stuff, so you can then bring in more troops by parachute, and then you'll focus on a final objective, right? Like that kind of
right.
progressive linearity, right, where there's a hard point and you're progressively falling back.
And was that change I mean, I was on the engineering side, so I don't remember all of the decisions that were made, but was that change made because it was easier to balance that way? I remember some of the early levels were really lopsided when we actually play tested them.
That's definitely what it was.
And by the way, it's really hard to play test a 256 person game.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a whole nother thing, because that was nuts. Like, we were leveraging resources all throughout Sony. I mean,
yeah.
like people at Naughty Dog were playing, right? Like, people at Sucker Punch
shut
are playing.
Down everybody's
yeah,
QA
we're like,
department.
Hey guys, can you like come and check out this crazy game? Like, and the first couple of months, everybody did. And then yeah. they're like, dude, fuck you guys. We have games to make. But yeah, so I mean, that was it really was progressive, right? Where we'd have these large scale play tests, and you know, we were very limited in what we could replicate in terms of total player numbers. So you know, maybe we'd be lucky if we got 60 players or 100. You know, and even then, it's like, okay, with a 256 player game, it's representative to a point. But even then, we could tell that it was super freeform, and we would have had to change a lot of really core game mechanics mm-hmm. in order to provide the structure, you know, to make a round-based multiplayer game that actually made sense.
Right.
So instead of just changing a shitload of the mechanics, what we decided to do is just create a framework that was progressive, that drove people forward, right? And it was a little more linear because of that, but the maps were still huge. So,
yeah.
You know, and you had a lot of flexibility within it. So, yeah, it came organically over
time.
Well,
in fact, weren't it's years ago, and I don't really remember, but weren't most of the 256-player maps kind of like just four smaller 64-player maps kind of
so that,
stacked
that's,
together?
So that whole concept we were talking about the progression, right,
yeah,
where
yeah.
it's like I go in, I hit a line of bunkers, and then I hit a anti-aircraft or whatever, or artillery piece, and then I move in to the final objective, in which we, like, come in and, like, you know, 60 people at a time are uh-huh. parachuting onto onto an objective, which sounds totally normal now because it's like, oh, I play Fortnite. That happens all the time, whatever. But it's like, yeah, this was like 2005.
Yeah, Jesus, it was.
Yeah. Anyway.
It's been a lot of beer since then.
Yeah, so many. So the concept just evolved, right? Because we tried to have 64 player matches, 128 player matches, and 256 player matches. Mm-hmm. So we're basically rubber stamping it, right? So we took that concept, and then it went from that to be expanded to like a parallel where you'd have a side by side of the same.
Right.
And then the 256 player match looked like a D-pad, right? So you've got like the four cardinal directions all mashing in the center. And the end on that was insane though, because it was 256 people mashing together at once around a giant central objective that was just nuts.
Right.
So yeah, nostalgic for Mag. It was good times.
I still remember some of the tests that we did where we'd 256 players was such a huge number back then, nobody believed we could do it. Mm. And we would have these play tests where we would try to get all 256 players on the screen.
Yep.
And this was a controlled environment where we had QA within Sony there and whatever.
Yeah.
And just setting everybody up to get the screenshot just to prove that you could do it. And one fucking asshole throws a grenade right in the middle of a big group.
Right, cool.
Blows everybody up. And
frames
then you have to reset.
Down to like three, maybe crash the server.
And then you reset for 15 minutes just to get, you know, these are our employees that we could threaten to fire, and they're still fucking around.
What is the bottleneck with all those that number of players? What's holding back?
The bottleneck in terms of frame rate?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, performance in general.
Performance in general, it's really, you want to have a really good-looking game when you have, you know, two players on screen.
Right.
So you push everything to the edge, right? You have as many polygons and the highest-res textures that you can to make that scenario look good. The problem is once you get 256 players on screen.
Right.
You know, you're pushing now, you know, 200 times the stuff through the chip, and it just can't handle it.
Yeah.
So what you really do on big games like that is you optimize for kind of your most common crowded scenario, you know, and in the actual game of Mag, even though there were 256 players, you would never get those people in a group because you're shooting each other.
Right.
So you might have 16 players on screen. Maybe, or they're 20.
Maybe
or
30.
But
you're
blowing each other up pretty quickly at that point. So you kind of, from a tech point of view, you optimize for that case of like 20 or 30 players. But yeah, if you go over that, you see this on all MMOs, right? When you get a big crowded city or whatever, the frame rate just goes to shit because you just can't push all that at once.
One thing that I want to note, just for people who are actually interested in how this shit works, I was always fascinated in talking with guys like Nate Klee and guys
Nate Klee was our core lead engineer, network engineer, super smart guy.
Oh my god! Or Nicolino, like those guys, they would go and they would talk about how, like, I'm like, how the fuck are you doing this, right? and they would just, the easiest way to explain it was like a cone of updates, right?
Yep.
So the closer you were to the center of the circle, the more updates you would get per frame, right? So, like, you know, frame rate, like 60 frames per second, like, I want that, right? So the number of updates you're getting per frame from the server, too, was greatly expanded based on distance. So if I'm 5 feet away from Ryan and looking to shoot him in the face, I'm going to get a lot of updates on his actions, right? Whereas someone maybe 100 meters out, there are going to be significantly less. Like maybe I'll get like two updates per frame, whereas for Ryan, I was getting 10.
You know
what I mean?
Yeah. That's why if you look way in the back, you could see people skipping along.
Right, I see.
But you don't really care at that point, right?
Well, there's so much happening that, you know, that's just like background noise. It's like you're hardly ever going to focus on that.
Well, and that's what sucks whenever you throw a sniper into the game, right? Because once you're looking through a sniper scope, even though that guy in game is 100 meters away, you want to see him update all the time because he's really close to you.
Right, so that's about moving your update cone from the player's position to the cone
focus
around the actual the scope itself.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing is like, oh, I'm going to no scope and just go back and forth. It's like, you, like, network engineers hate you, just so you know. You're a terrible person.
So one other thing I wanted to ask about in the context of Mag, just because this is kind of where I first realized this is a design construct, but I know it applies further on, and we'll move throughout the rest of your career and kind of see how this applies. But that was the first game where we really talked about what we called the pillars of the game. And this is something, you know, I kind of try to get across when I'm talking to people, newer people who have an idea for a game. And usually they pitch me plot. They pitch me, here's the plot of the game I want to make. And while that's interesting, it doesn't help any of us as game makers really make the game.
Right.
So I don't know. Maybe you could explain the concept of what pillars of a game are and give examples of you know, what they might be and how they're applied.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think I'll take another step back first. And
I'm open
and
to the Jameson, too, by the way, if you don't mind.
That's really a step forward. But I'll take a step back and talk about game development philosophy, which is really where you need to start, right? And every game designer will tell you that they have their own unique philosophy. It's good for you.
let me get some of that.
I haven't hit Jameson in a while.
We're talking about the liquor, right? So everyone has their own unique philosophy and approach to making games, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes it takes the length of a career for that philosophy to intersect with the right pillars and the right team mm-hmm. and the right budget and the right marketing allocation and the right timing, right? So that's why a lot of times you'll see really, really great game makers struggle in some ways or work on like middling products or whatever. Like there's a million different reasons why it could happen, but I think ultimately over time you're going to develop a philosophy, and if you focus on that and refine it and ensure that that is instilled in every aspect of the product and the people that are around you that are working it, and everyone believes like, hey, this is what we're trying to do, you're going to build a good product. Mm-hmm. Now, once you've established that, and just quick examples, that could be like players first or like every action matters, okay. or something like that, right? Like just high level stuff where it's like, I'm really focused on this and this is going to inform everything else. So start there. And then you think about the pillars of the game, right? So you mentioned plot. That's cool. Like everybody has a story idea, yeah, right? Yeah. And that's important, right? Like eventually that will be really, really important. But
right.
a game is ultimately about mechanics, right?
Right.
And establishing a world and the mechanics of your game need to be broken down into a certain subset into so that you can clearly message that not only throughout your team mm-hmm. But to the public so that they get it, right? Like you're like, what is this game? You're like, oh, well, it's a Metroidvania in space with aliens with giant dildos on their head. You're like, fucking got it. Yes, that sounds amazing.
Is that Calamity? Is that the project you're working on?
That is, I can't talk about Calamity. maybe. And that's like a pitch, right? That's not
right.
your pillars. But you need something that allows you to clearly disseminate that information to others, right?
Right?
So in terms of pillars, this is really important in terms of getting your game made, right? Mm-hmm. Because those are the things that you're going to establish with a publisher.
Right.
Not only just your team, but like a publisher at large to convince them to build your game.
Right.
So a pillar could be like third-person action combat, right?
Okay.
Or massively multiplayer, or
right.
endlessly replayable, or dogs on drugs,
right,
or
right.
you know, whatever. But like you need to establish a certain number of those in order to clearly set up what you're trying to accomplish with the game.
Right. Yeah. And you know, one area that I've always used these is when you're developing a game, you know, over a number of years, people always have a billion ideas. Wouldn't this be cool? Wouldn't
right.
it be cool if we had self-driving cars that crashed off cliffs and whatever?
Right.
And you could use those pillars to kind of gauge whether or not a feature idea is applicable to the game. Right?
Yes.
You could say, that sounds cool that you have, you know, an explosive that you stick to the refrigerator and it blows up, but does that support what these pillars are?
Yes, very much so. And just like design philosophy, every idea that you have, every choice that you're making in the game should fall back upon those. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't check out, if it doesn't fit within that framework, you need to do one of two things. Either throw that shit away, right? Well, three things, sorry. Throw it the fuck away or refine it,
right?
And come back and say like, okay, well, now this works within the framework.
Right, right.
Right? Oh, God, what was the third one? I don't know. Give me the Jameson.
There you go.
We'll leave that to our listeners to figure out what the third one is.
Yeah, they can figure it out what it is.
I'm trying to think.
I'd be curious about some examples of how those pillars apply to maybe some games that, like, I don't know, or I would be aware of or something. Something.
Oh, so, okay.
Like, you know what
so,
I mean?
So one of the first exposures of pillars to the public.
Right.
God, I can't remember that. One of the creative directors on Diablo was talking about the pillars that they had for their game, and I think there were like seven.
Okay. That's a lot, actually.
Three is pretty normal. Five, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Seven is like, you're either trying to cover a shitload of ground or you can't really focus on what your game actually is.
Right.
But in the case of Diablo, like every single one of those things is applicable, so I'm not going to judge.
well, it made a few dollars.
Yeah, it's an okay game, you know, whatever. but like one of theirs, like Endlessly Replayable, I think was actually one of theirs.
Right.
And theirs was, another one was like, oh, I can't remember the adjective, but it was like awesome loot or like shitloads of loot or something like that. And those things, you're like, okay, cool. So now I'm thinking about, all right, how do I define a dungeon, right? So I know that at the end of this dungeon, because shitloads of loot is one of my pillars, I'm going to want to have shitloads of loot. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm going to get great loot,
right?
But I'm going to get a shitload of loot after I go through and kill all these skeletons or whatever, right? I know that that's going to be a part of that. So you, any aspect of what you're building, whether it's a level or a quest or a mission or like a PvE encounter or whatever, it's like, is that informed by our philosophy and does it fit within one of the core pillars slash tenets of the game?
And well, that gets defined in the beginning. Or should be.
Yeah. Right? Ideally.
That's funny.
Or is that something that develops as the development process unfolds?
Develops and evolves are two different things, right? So look, like in the ideal case, that is one of the first things that you really set up. But what really happens is games are about iteration, right? Mm. And what a game actually is and is defined by usually comes about over the course of time. It's not like, you know, some game designers, you know, brilliant, amazing fucking people are like, this is exactly what the game is. I have the complete vision in my head. I can see it soup to nuts now. Here are the pillars and everything I do is going to fit into this now. Right. No problem. Done. But generally what happens is you set some stakes in the ground, right? You're like, these are the things we want to focus on and you explore, right? So you could say like in the case of like the new God of War, it's you're like, I want to see what happens when we add a passive player to the experience, right? And I can control that player in a limited capacity, limited and increasing capacity, and it serves to benefit my overall gameplay experience. Now, cool, that's defined, right? But like loosely. So like, what does that actually mean? Does that mean does that mean I can do what it is in the game and I can press like square and Atreus is going to shoot arrows and like help me, you know, stun an enemy and assist my overall goals? Maybe that's what you start out with, or maybe it takes years to get to that, right? You don't necessarily know. So much of game development is really about iteration and comes over these long periods of time. So don't feel like, you know, you can send some posts in the ground, but don't feel like you have to be stuck on those things either, right? It's going to evolve. As you're building this game, these things are going to change. But if they change too much, just know that maybe you might be falling a little bit away from what you were trying to build originally, and you should check yourself and really see, like, okay, like, does this... Are we really trying to build the same game anymore? Or do we even know what we're doing, right?
Yeah, things, especially with design, tend to spiral out really quickly. You know, there's no shortage of ideas, no shortage of good ideas, too. But, you know, it's really about limiting that to something that you could build and trying to get the best nuggets out of that. So, yeah, I think the pillars, it's a concept that certainly helped me narrow that stuff down.
Hey, I'm going to grab, let's keep going. I'm going to grab some more beer.
Okay, yeah, I was going to say, I'm
thirsty.
Out of beer. So,
okay, coming up.
Usually we take a break here, but we'll keep talking through it. let's talk, since we were at Zipper together, what are some funny stories you remember from that?
We were
in crunch mode for a year on that game, like a year, a real year straight.
Was it only a year?
Maybe it was more than that. I remember I only had 2 weekends off for a whole year. I had 2 weekends off out of 52.
I mean, you did sleep at the office even when we weren't crunching though, so like,
yeah, that's true. well, that's only because we were so drunk we didn't want to drive home.
That's true. So, I will say this: like, we spent more time in development on that game than any other game I've shipped since. Like 4 years in development, and I did an extra over a year of live service on that game.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Which is incredibly uncommon,
Especially back then.
Yeah. Yeah, so, because live service games, especially on console, weren't really a thing then, right? So we were pioneering a bunch of insane shit with that title. I couldn't say. What are your thoughts on
that? Oh, geez, I mean, do you remember when He got harassed by the cops because they thought he was the molester.
Oh, sorry. You're crazy. For whatever reason, I thought you were like, how much vacation did you get on that game? I'm like, I don't know. None. I died.
There was a bicycle path near the office, and I guess there was some flasher who was hiding in the bushes or something.
Wait, oh, is this a real thing?
Yeah, this is a real thing. There's some flasher who's hiding in the bushes, and came out like either really late at night or really early in the morning from having done a full night there, and there were cops waiting, and they like arrested him because they thought he was the molester guy. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just he because could he was have in been. The parking lot.
You're going to have to bleep that name, by the way, on that story. But yeah, there were insane times. There was a guy who used to take the poop naps.
Oh my God. So our buddy developed this thing, which is genius. And I really hope he's still doing this because he definitely still makes games. But holy fuck. This is I don't care if you're in games or not. This is a brilliant idea. So he developed this concept called poo naps. And basically, the gist of it is you're in the shitter for so long that your legs fall asleep. So
remember, this is the days before smartphones, too.
That's true. Yeah. So there's no, like, I'm sitting there playing Crash Royale for like 35 minutes and my legs fall asleep and I'm like, oh God. And then like waddle like a duck who's just given birth to 20 ducklings down the hall. No, this is like legitimately, unless you brought the paper or a magazine into the stall, you didn't really have much going on. This was even pre PSP days. So like, you know, I don't know. Maybe you had like an old school Nintendo or something you could do, but nobody did that shit. Right. That's really weird. Yeah. And like the amount of shit that's going to end up, like actual poo that's going to end up on your your console is just weird. So this guy, ahead of his time, obviously brilliant, he develops this philosophy. He says like, look, I'm going to go in and take a shit. I'm going to chill out and it's going to be my Zen time. Like I'm going to let it go. And then I'm just going to kind of let myself stagger into the end of the stall and I'm going to take a little nap and I'll wake up when I wake up. And here's the thing. Nobody's going to bother me, right? I know this is a safe space for me and I can get a couple things done, right? I can get the poo out and get a nap in. And then he would come back and go to work. You know, he'd stay at work till 7-8 or whatever. He'd do what he needed to do. It's not like he was a slacker. He just, you know, he needed his little midday poo nap. And I applaud him.
It's really brilliant.
I honestly feel like we should bring naps back into the workplace.
I totally agree with this.
I mean, not necessarily in a bathroom stall, but
yeah, that could get a little weird. I remember, God, there was a story about how we had to fire somebody, and the HR director went in and fired him, and it was a real emotional thing. He was a good guy, but he just wasn't working out.
So he wasn't performing or something. Yeah, so delivering or
we let this guy go, and you know, it, for good reason. But he knew it was coming, but he was very sad, and I think he actually started crying, and started packing up his office. But like 5 minutes later, he had to walk into the director of HR's office because his wife had dropped him off that day, and he needed a ride home.
So
the person who fired him had to then put him in her car and drive him home while he was crying with this little box of stuff. And
very
she started
that's
crying. I know, it's terrible.
That's the worst thing ever. That place was crazy. I mean, it's interesting because it was a couple of days ago. We were talking about like motivations, like get up to work in the day and like, you know, get you through really tough times, because I think people have a better perspective on it now, but this industry is really difficult. You know, it's by no means is it a cakewalk. It's like, oh, you get to come in and play games all day and like you just like sit there and read Reddit and like maybe go to the bathroom and take a poo nap and that's your day. Like, no, there's actually real tangible work and we work our asses off, especially games these days take an incredible amount to produce. I mean, it is
it's
millions
of people,
and millions and millions
of dollars
and hundreds of people across multiple studios all over the world and years of your life.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a passion, obviously, which is why you make these sacrifices and we love it. But crazy shit happens, whereas like you can be in the darkest days of crunch, right? And for those who don't know, crunch is periods where you're spending an inordinate amount of time in the office, generally pushing towards a milestone or shipping the game.
Yeah,
just trying to get the game out the door, right? So that means, you know, I'm there who knows how early, 8, 9, whatever. I love that 9 is early.
Yeah, in our industry, 9.
Yeah, but you're there early, right? And then you're working through lunch generally, and then they bring you dinner, and then you're staying there till 8, 9, 10, midnight, I mean, yeah. 1 a.m., 2.
Sometimes they're pulling all-nighters or sleeping under your desk.
Exactly.
I've slept under my desk countless times.
Just most of those were voluntary, for the record.
Most of them were passing out under my desk.
Anyway, that shit's intense, man. And during those times, things can get really stressful. So, you know, it was interesting relating with a colleague a couple of days ago talking about, like, what do you guys do to relieve stress during crunch? And, like, I didn't say this because it's not the professional
thing. I'm terrified where you're going with this.
It's not the professional thing to say, right? Because, like, what you do generally is, like, take some time out. Like, we try to get, like, massages for people, or, like, get out of the office, go for a walk for a little while or whatever. Like, those are all, you know, go to a movie, something to, like, get everybody's mind off it and put them at ease. But I've been at several studios where alternate methods have been employed, including where it was like, hey, say like 10 a.m., why don't we all load into a van and just get real liquored up and bar hop all day, and maybe we end up at a strip club, maybe we end up on the corner, maybe we end up back at the office, I don't know. But either way, we're going to blow some steam off today and make it happen. And I didn't say that, obviously, but it's the first thing that popped into my mind. I'm like, you know, sometimes it's good to just, you know, just get real loaded.
We actually had to call an ambulance for one guy. He got so liquored up that he was passed out in the bathroom. We had to pour him into an ambulance.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
That's what stress will do to you.
Wow.
It's dangerous.
Yeah, you monitor your stress, people. Yeah. Don't be the guy that passes out in the bathroom.
Actually, at that studio, I went into the doctor once and had an EKG because I thought I was having a heart attack. I was so stressed out, I was having chest pains and heart palpitations.
Jesus.
Yeah, that's not uncommon.
Yeah, I honestly, like, these times are really stressful. So, I like, not to caution people about getting into the industry, because if you're passionate about making video games, you absolutely should. But just know, it's not, it ain't no cupcakes. I mean, it is a lot of hard work in the interim and some really, really stressful times, especially to make a really quality game. Some of you, I don't know when this is going to air, but like last week there was a video that came out, of Corey Barlog from Santa Monica Studio, who just released God of War, right? Getting, you know, it's going to be game of the year probably. And some people are saying the best game ever, but like there's incredible hyperbole coming out about this game, and it is fucking great. So you should play it. But there was a video of him, watching, like recording himself, like reading through all the reviews as they went live. And which is a really dangerous prospect.
Yeah, because if it's negative, this is going to be difficult
that
to swallow.
That shit is
brutal.
It's going to be hard to swallow.
Yeah, you've just spent years of your life crunching away at this, and people just tear it down.
Yeah, and I think, honestly, it was on Twitter today, David Goldfarb came out. David Goldfarb, who did like Payday and worked on multiple Battlefield titles, including Bad Company, like badass game developer,
right.
Came out and he's like, yeah, you don't want to see the video of the other side of these reactions, right? And he's totally right, because the inverse is brutal. Like, you know, we feel this shit directly, and it's you know, we process everything through forums and Reddit and we read everything, right? Because every input matters to us.
Sure.
And you have to develop a really thick skin, because it's really tough. But I think especially with the critics, they can be, because there's a score attributed to it, there's something about that that's like unnecessarily harsh. But it, you know, in the inverse, you're watching Corey watch, you know, his masterpiece come through, which is, you know, years in the making. He's worked on all the God of Wars. Like, he's finally at this place where he's built the best game ever, right? And he's crying, and it's visibly there. And it's like, I think it, you know, to me, I can't speak for him, but to me, what I'm seeing is years of frustration and angst and passion and love and fury all coming together into a singular moment where it's recognized at this point as it was all worth it. You know what I mean? Because game development is this insane journey. Absolutely crazy. It makes no sense. But there are moments where it's all worthwhile. Yeah. And sometimes that's a team meeting where, you know, your people show up and they deliver something fucking fantastic and the whole team feels great about it and everybody's stoked, right? Sometimes that's oh my God, I thought we were going to close the studio and we just got another 6 months.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's building the best game ever, finally, after years and years and years, getting your own shot to build your own thing. And it is amazing. It's everything you wanted it to be and getting the recognition for it. I don't know. I found that fascinating. That's why I wanted to bring it up.
Well, let's take a quick break.
Yeah.
And we'll be right back. All right.
Hey, D3 Podcast listeners, Jeremy here. Thank you so much for listening to our project. We hope that you're really enjoying it. We've got even more exciting stuff coming up here in the future. We've got some great guests lined up on deck. And we've even got some travel planned. We got some recording we're going to do on the road that we think you're really going to enjoy. But we do need your support. If you do indeed enjoy the show, please visit d3podcast.com and like, subscribe, and join all of our social medias there and spread the word. If you could share anything, that would be great. So thank you so much for listening, and let's get back to the show.
All right. We are back after hearing a word from our sponsors.
Oh, yeah. Who's our sponsor?
Our sponsor. We don't have these sponsors yet. We're looking for sponsors. Yeah. If you're a sponsor.
If you work at National Bohemian Beer.
Yeah. Yes. Contact us immediately.
All right, so we've talked a lot about Zipper. So I ended up getting laid off from there.
Really?
After we shipped Mag, and I think SOCOM shipped after Mag, right?
Yes.
SOCOM 4. So it was between that, because we were going down to one team. There was a live team on Mag and the SOCOM team. So I got laid off. But how did that end for you? Because they ended up closing the studio down.
So I got out before that. So it was crazy. Just really quickly, by the time we'd gone to ship Mag, Andy had left. Somehow I became the primary spokesperson for the game. Yep. So I was going all over the world talking about Mag and like doing the whole press tour for Mag right before its launch. And then worked on the live service for that game for 6 months to a year or whatever. And in parallel was working on SOCOM, which was the other game. It was a game that the studio was known for. Mm-hmm. But really, I didn't have anything to do with, as soon as I was done with live service, I became a firefighter, and they're like, hey, we need you on this. We need you on that. We need you on this. And can you redesign the entire UI in 6 weeks? I'm like, sure. So things like that. But mostly I was on the road promoting a game that I had never done a lot of work on, which was really strange.
Yeah.
It was probably even stranger for the people that were intimately involved in that product and having me come in and be like, hey, this game's awesome. You know, it's like, it was a really weird time. But anyway, as that was transpiring, I kind of saw the writing on the wall. I'm like, this shit is not built to last. Like, I just, people like you, I'd forgotten that you'd gotten laid off, but a lot of good people got let go because we were downsizing to one team or whatever thing else. And I was just like, man, this game is not going to sing. I don't have a good feeling. Even though we were first party at Sony, which is like, if you're first party at Sony, generally...
What first party means what?
So first party developer is owned by the publisher, right? So like a Naughty Dog... Sucker Punch, Bend, like all those studios are owned by Sony, right? So you're making games specifically and exclusively for whatever platform they're pushing. So in that time, PlayStation 3, right?
Yeah.
So usually those studios are safe. In this case, I felt like it wasn't. And I kind of reached out and had an opportunity to jump on the Medal of Honor team and was glad I did, because Zipper shut down maybe 6 months later. Yeah. No, 6 months or 8 months later, after they shipped another game for PSP, I think.
Was that Confrontation?
No. It was something 13.
Oh, yeah.
It was Jeremy's big thing. So Jeremy, one of our colleagues, went on to actually have a very, very foundational role in this small title you've never heard of called Rocket League. But that was like his... first title that where he really cut his teeth on it, but I was gone by that point. So anyway, I went on to EA and I worked on Medal of Honor Warfighter.
And that was EA down in LA, right?
Yeah, EA LA. Yeah, so that was the studio that Spielberg built. It was called DreamWorks Interactive originally, and they built that to kind of make a companion game to Saving Private Ryan, which ended up being Medal of Honor.
Mm-hmm. Is that right? I wasn't aware of that.
That's what they did, DreamWorks Interactive. That was still our network domain when I got there, which is hilarious. So that was the whole deal. And, I ended up working on the last Medal of Honor, which is like a weird distinction because it's almost like... that was the strangest game ever, man. There were like eight creative directors on that game. But because I was on
At one time?
At one time. No, at one time.
I mean, how many are there typically?
Usually there's just one.
One to three, depending on the scope of the game, right? Yeah. So you could have like a single player creative director, executive creative director that overlooks everything, maybe one for multiplayer, maybe one for something else, whatever. But having more than two or three is incredibly uncommon. But for whatever reason, bloat or whatever else, this studio had a shitload of creative directors, and many of them were at odds as to what this game should be. Fascinating. But because I was on multiplayer, I was really insulated, right? So we had one creative director, Christoph Bergquist, who came over from DICE. Guy knew his shit. Like, we were running our own little team. We had a vision for it, and we executed against it. And, you know, we thought we were doing great. But the single-player game for that product ended up being such a disaster because it was rolled up in all this controversy. The game didn't really come together. Then EA Corporate came in and like sacked a bunch of those creative directors and brought in their own people from Visceral and were like, all right, now you're in charge of the title, remake it. So they took all the content they had, reshuffled it, and were like, we're doing these two things instead and make two new levels at the beginning of the game, and this is what the game is. And if that sounds like a mess to you, trust me, it was definitely a mess for us and for the consuming public.
Unfortunately, it's not uncommon in a lot of titles, especially EA games. EA is such a huge entity that a lot of times they switch things up on games like that, and it really causes some confusion.
Yeah, it was crazy. Absolutely crazy. But, you know, we were really proud of what we had made in the multiplayer side, and we had gotten some awards at E3, and we were like, all right, cool. Like, people get this. Like, this is an evolution of multiplayer. We were doing some interesting things. And by the time the game shipped, like, we were mired in so much controversy. Like, we could have had the next Call of Duty, and no one would have given a fuck. It was insane, dude. Right. Like, we were, like, as a studio, we were like, working on a TV show and like multiple other web spinoffs, and like we had actual Navy SEALs in the studio like every month, like consulting on the project, which obviously ended up being a huge problem. if you ever read about that, massive conflicts of interest. And
what happened with that? You mean having these consultants that?
Yeah, so you can read about this, and I don't know how much detail I can go into it, but we had a lot of special operations consultants on the project, including guys that were like on the Bin Laden mission, including guys that had got in trouble for talking about that, also very much got in trouble for talking, like being involved in this project, because DOD and like anybody else, like the Secretary of Defense's office, like anybody else didn't know about this. They were all doing this on the side while they were still active duty, which is a huge no-no. I didn't know any of this at the time. I just thought it was awesome. They were like, hey, this fucking Navy SEAL is going to sit down over your shoulder and tell you whether or not the level you're building is realistic. I'm like, cool. Sweet, dude. Like, hey, are these terrorists in the right place? I didn't even know what the right questions to ask because it was so ridiculous.
Right.
But it was fucking crazy, too. I'm glad I got to go through it. So anyway, jumping forward through that, that studio obviously shut down, and there were maybe, God, I want to say like 30 of us that survived and reformed as DICE Los Angeles, with a bunch of executive leadership that came over from Stockholm, and then we were tasked to work on DLC for Battlefield 4, which is where I got like my first real lead opportunity. So I got to be a lead designer on the first expansion pack for Battlefield 4, which was Second Assault, which was basically a reimagining of classic Battlefield maps through time, right? So, but fitting them into the construct of Battlefield 4 and modernizing all the system components and ensuring that it met up with the standards of that title, which was really challenging, especially with like super nostalgic maps, right? Firestorm, like, and Metro,
things everybody that knows them,
hundreds and hundreds of hours into, right? And it's like, how do I take something that's great and innovate upon it, and still make it palatable and make it something that people like it builds upon the legacy of this map, as opposed to being like, the old version was better, blah blah blah. You know what I mean? Like that's a huge challenge, one of the biggest of my career. And I think it was fascinating to see how that progressed, because obviously there were some technical challenges along the way with that game, and we were trying to build DLC before the game was done, which is anybody who's in development will tell you that's really, really tough because your feature set isn't locked, right? Like you, mm-hmm. your tech stack isn't locked.
Yep.
Your network isn't optimized. Like you can't test against it. All the resources in terms of testing are actually going towards the retail product and not what you're trying to do. So
you're doubling your work. I mean, you're going to have to do a lot of that again, right? I mean,
yeah. Well, and you're guessing. You're guessing a lot, right? Yeah. Like much of what we try to do is informed on data and practice mm-hmm. and like playtesting. And a lot of designers will tell you like, well, that shit doesn't matter. I go with my gut. And it's like, cool. like you can do that. But like really modern approaches to game design, irrespective of how much you take from those other levels of input, take some form of input from, play test feedback at least, right? Or just getting people in to do like focus testing of like what this product is. Like, how do you feel about this? Like, on a number basis, tell me about how you're feeling, right? That all these things inform the process. And then you have things like betas and all that other stuff to kind of fit in. How much of that impetus you take as a designer is really up to you, but I feel like the discipline is evolving really fast to the point where if you're not taking that stuff into a certain degree and you're not focused on data, which is, you know, the biggest input we have right now, telemetry and, business intelligence really informing how we work on these things. I think you're doing yourself and your community a disservice. That's my own perspective, but I think those things are really important and are becoming more so with each day. Our access to those things was relatively limited, right? Because again, most of the resources were going towards a retail product and something that worked, whereas our shit was like, we can't play test for this month, maybe next month. You're like, oh God.
Yeah, it's so hard.
It was really tough. But
imagine shooting a movie where you can't watch dailies or you can't watch a playback of what you just shot.
It's really limiting.
Be super tough. Well, and then the other thing that happened was they doubled the amount of content for the pack. Was 6 weeks before ship. So they're like, we were set up to do two levels. And then they're like, yeah, we actually want four. And because, the whole concept of levolution, right, which was I can impact the environment with my actions in any way and like crazy shit happens,
right.
Which is the huge, that was a pillar for Battlefield 4.
Yeah, that's right. It's like destructible environments.
Exactly. Highly destructible. Yeah. And it evolved gameplay because of that, right? So,
sure.
Not only you have to like, it's not like I would just take Operation Firestorm and be like, all right, cool, yeah, no big deal. Like, make the textures nicer and ship it. Like, no, it's like, how do I make this interactive? How do I make it progressive?
Right.
Like, what can we change to actually bring intrigue and build upon the legacy of this map? Huge challenges in a truncated time period. So, So my time at EA was very interesting.
And how long were you working on Battlefield?
So I worked on Battlefield for about 2 years.
Okay.
So we shipped, DICE LA shipped the majority of the expansion packs for Battlefield 4, did all the live service components as well. So, our studio handled all the patches and updates and everything else that took that game from where it started, which, admittedly was a challenging place. I think anybody that either played that game or can go back and look at it said like where it started was really rough. But I give a lot of credit to the people that I worked with and that they took that and built it into something that was amazing over that period of time. By the time the final DLC was shipping for Battlefield 4, I think all of us were really, really proud with that product because it evolved into something amazing.
Right, right. Well, so you got done with that and you decided to go indie, right?
Yes.
So yeah, this is something I wanted to, indie has become such a big slice of the game development population now.
Right.
It's kind of fascinating for me that you were AAA for so long and then you went indie for a while now, since then you went back to AAA. So how did the indie thing start? How did that even happen?
That's crazy. Well, so first let me say that there are generally two roads, right? And it's not never the two shall pass, right? But generally you're either an indie developer or you're some level of, I don't want to say professional development because I definitely view indie development as professional as well. It's just about structure, right? But some level of professional developer, whether it's like AA, AAA, whatever, rarely do people bounce back and forth. That's not really a thing, right? Famous indie developers stay indie.
Right.
The famous AAA developers stay AAA. Mm-hmm. I've never been famous, so like I guess it was okay for me to go back and forth, right? It's not really something that a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. But there was a period of time, a couple years back, like right around the time that Unreal Engine 4 was coming out, where a lot of AAA developers looked at this tool set and said, and the business opportunity around it, we're saying like, okay, I can take this and it's not going to cost me a lot of money and I can take a little bit of risk and put something together, and Steam is super hot right now. Yeah. And like with this whole Greenlight thing, we can get in here into this like limited marketplace and probably make some money and build a good game, right? And a lot of us jumped around the same time. So during that period, several of my colleagues from DICE and then one of my buddies from grad school who had just finished shipping Lost Planet all kind of looked at that a business opportunity and said, hey, like, I think this is our time. Like, let's go out and try to make something and try to do it on our own, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we'd been in AAA for a long time. We'd been through a lot of shit. And we're, you know, admittedly frustrated. And, you know, I think a lot of people like who take that route are like, I can do it better, right? And you know, to a certain degree, I think we felt that way, but we also looked at the resources that we had at our ability, at our disposal, and our collective abilities, and said, okay, like we can probably make something happen. Like, what? You know, fuck it. Like, let's just go build a game, right? Like, we've established ourselves in this industry to the point, like, you know, even if this thing blows up in our face, like we can go get jobs tomorrow. I'm not worried about
it. Yeah, you can find work.
Yeah, you can find work. It's not going to be the end of the world. And it's not like we're like super happy right now. You know what I mean? Like DICE LA was an amazing studio and it still is. But I think we were all just kind of burned out.
Yeah.
And like, you know, like all of us at that point had been in AAA development for at least 10 years. So we were like, you know what? Time for something new.
Yeah.
That was the time that we took.
So did you self-fund? I mean, was this with your own cash or did you get funding?
So this was also during a fascinating time, the Kickstarter boom.
Oh, okay. I didn't know you guys were Kickstarter.
Boom. Yeah. So, that was another writing on the wall kind of thing where we thought, okay, we can actually go do this, right?
You'll crowdsource your funding.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Like we were not rich. And we don't have a ton of resources at our disposal, but we know how to make games.
You got talent.
Yeah, we got some talent, and we got some cachet, and you know, there's money out there, right? Yeah. And there's this new platform in Unreal Engine 4, and you know, Steam is hot, and we could probably do this, right? So we looked at that and said, like, all right, let's give it a shot. So I really focused on a Kickstarter for probably like 6 months. I did a shitload of research and really dove into what we needed to do. And, you know, some of our other partners like dove in and like, they're like, hey, he's like, hey, I know a videographer, like, let's get him in. It's like, oh, I know a guy that can give us a space that we can shoot in. Okay, cool. Like, so you start putting these things together and it's like, oh, I can build the website. I can do that. Right. So we're all collaboratively making these things happen. And, you know, and we're trying to hustle on the side and like, you know, we had some friends help out and some family that kicked in a little money. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that helped get us started. So we weren't starving when we went to do this.
Are you at liberty to say what the total budget of the game was? Or?
Yeah, so the total budget of the game was $250,000.
Okay, and that's—I know that sounds like a lot of money, but that's slim.
That's nothing.
That keeps you operating for.
Our runway for the entire game was a year.
Right,
but I mean, that's you got to buy equipment, got to license Unreal at some level, right? You pay for software licensing, you know, you need a compiler that costs money, you need a modeling package that costs money.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, so go on with my business
costs, Ryan. Please bring up all these pains that I've gone through.
Well, it's just you know, $250,000 is not that's bare bones nothing.
Yeah, yeah, it was super limited, and I can remember at the time when we announced, so like when we went live on Kickstarter, right? And like I remember there was like a post for our game on NeoGAF that was like getting a good amount of traction, and one of the moderators who was there all the time when NeoGAF was a thing, like jumped on and he's like, yeah, he's like, this actually looks really fucking cool, but like these guys are only asking for like 115 grand or whatever, like 75 grand, I think is what we asked for. They're like, he's fucking crazy. He's like, this game is going to cost at least $250,000 to make. And I'm like, in my head, I'm like, yeah, I know, but nobody knows that we have like some money stashed away.
Right.
But it turns out that we were both wrong. You know what I mean? Like what this game was going to cost to build was way more. We had done tons of analysis and projection of what this was going to be and what it was going to cost. and we were all wrong. And I think there are, you know, there are a lot of things that came into play there.
How are you? You underestimated.
We definitely underestimated. Yeah,
by how much?
It's hard to say because you build the game that you can, and then you can build the game that you want to make, right? And to build the game that I think we wanted to make probably would have taken $1 million. And even that, to be from a budgetary perspective, is pretty limited, right? Yeah. In terms of, there was this whole thing with it's like, oh, it's like indie AAA or whatever, but like, that's all bullshit. It's just like super high polished indie, right? So like, there are a lot of amazing games, regardless of aesthetic, the indie games that are made with super low budgets, mm-hmm. right? Like Metroidvanias or side scrollers or whatever, right? Like irrespective of platform, that are amazing fucking games and they don't take $1 million to make. But the game that we wanted to make and share with the world, I think ultimately probably would have taken $1 million to make to quality and would have given us the runway that we needed to make it.
So can you talk a little bit about what the game was? What did it start as sure. and what did it end up being?
So the game is called Into the Stars. It was a Kickstarter project, obviously. And I think ultimately we raised like $115,000 on Kickstarter.
That's really good.
Which was pretty good.
What year was that? That was...
good question. 2011? 2012?
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, but this was also in Kickstarter's heyday, right? And we were like, I timed it perfectly. We came out. We were the first game to launch. The start of the new year, right? Like right after people, it was like, I think it was like January 4th or 5th. It was like right after people were coming back from vacation. We were the first big game Kickstarter to launch of the year. And because of that, we got a shitload of press and it helped a lot.
That's smart.
Yeah. It helped. Yeah. And honestly, like we had good, we had good connections at Epic and they helped us a little out too, you know, and it was like, and we've been in the industry forever. So we're calling a shitload of favors and be like, hey, we got this thing. Anybody that can help in any way, appreciate it. Right. So we got some good traction. You know, we made some good money in the first week and then it kind of petered off. And part of that is planning on my own part and our team. I think we could have done better there, but, part of it was just the nature of it. Like what we were trying to build was also relatively limited. Like we kept the scope down. Because we're like, I can promise the world in a Kickstarter, right? And I can or an indie game and be like, I'm going to build an endlessly repeatable universe that is fully dynamic, that no one else will ever experience the same thing that you experience again.
I've never heard this pitch before.
It's crazy. and you could earn, you know, you could raise $100 million. But like, we've been in this industry a long time and we're realists and we're like, look, we don't want to pitch anything that we don't feel confident that we can't deliver upon. And that was a huge thing for us. And that kept us from putting out all
these. You were honest.
To a fault, because ultimately I think it hurt the product. I think if we'd pushed a little bit further and said, look, like, you know, here are the things that we really want to do and spend some more time really pushing it out, then we might have gotten the funds we'd needed to see it through in the way that we would have liked. Mm-hmm. But that didn't happen. We focused on what we could do and, so that's the money we raised and, yeah, it was an interesting journey. What else do you want to know about indie? Because fascinating subject.
Well, I want to know where that all went.
Yeah.
I mean, how does this end?
Yeah, I should probably put a bow on that. Sorry, I'm really I'm really focused on the bow that's in my hand as opposed to the one putting around the story. So that game, Into the Stars, so we ended up, because we were running out of money, we went to GDC, and we put that Game Developers Conference in San Francisco, and we put the game on the floor. And we were very open about the fact that we were looking for publishing agreements at that point, which we promised we didn't want to do. The whole point was we don't want to work with publishers. We want to do our own thing. And we fucked up. Like, we ran out of money. And I could see the writing on the wall. We were probably like 4 months out at that point. And I'm like, look, if we don't find a deal or some other form of fundraising, we're fucked.
You had already spent how much time at that point?
We had probably spent about 6 months at that point.
And you're saying you're 4 months away from
being just straight out of cash. Yeah.
Right.
Just not having any operating revenue and all of us would have been working. It would have been impossible.
Well, you guys were all, already working for free. Were you guys taking salaries off of this?
We were very minimal. We had basically cut our salaries by 2/3, after we left DICE. We were paying for rent and like I was making nachos for meals like five days a week, right? Like it was almost back to college days. And that's the indie lifestyle. Anybody tell you, like, especially the people that are truly dedicated to it, never, you know, risen to like AAA development. I'll
tell
you,
that's a sacrifice.
That's what you do. Like, what are you talking about? Nachos sound amazing. I was eating fucking ramen. You know, whatever. I mean, and they're right. That's, you know, those are the sacrifices that you make. But even at the minimum that we were paying ourselves and the number of favors that we were calling in and everything that we were doing from a hustling perspective, like I created this business plan that was like almost zero overhead, right? Like, because like we all worked at home, we had no rent or no like
overhead rent,
rent. Yeah. Like we didn't have an office. Yeah. We didn't have, you know, electricity bills or all this other shit. It was all our own independent stuff. You know, it was just our salaries. That was it. And the outsourcing that we were paying for. So it was super, super minimal. I mean, at $225, that's nothing. Yeah, you know what I mean? Like in AAA, you can spend that in an hour.
Oh, sure. Sure.
So we did that for as long as we could. We ended up signing a publishing agreement with a company in Europe, who had shipped a lot of space games, and we both thought we were pretty good for each other. We ended up shipping the game, well before we probably should have.
Right.
But even at that point, because we signed like a 6-month agreement with a publisher, we basically were running out of money there too. And it was either ship the game or just dissolve the studio and go bust. And all of us were to the point where it's like, look, irrespective of the product that we eventually ship, it is important for us to fulfill this promise and get this game out there to our supporters in terms of like our Kickstarter population.
Of course, yeah.
And our friends and like everyone else.
It goes back to your honesty. I mean, yeah.
Everybody else who had backed us, right? Like sure. That was the most important thing for us. And it was like, look, like, so we cut a fuckload of features and polish and everything else that we had to cut, which is really normal in developing any game, right? Those are the things that get cut, right? Are your want to have features and polish at the end of a product. But we had to cut a lot. More than we definitely wanted to. And, we shipped a cohesive game at the end of the day, but, you know, nowhere near what we wanted to. And the very interesting part of all of this is that in the year plus that it took us to make this, the ecosystem on Steam had shifted dramatically, right? So because of Greenlight, it had gone from...
And what is Greenlight again?
Greenlight was the process that Valve put in place on Steam, which is their huge distribution platform, to enable independent developers to be able to publish their products on Steam.
Got it.
So before that, it was like just companies like Bethesda and Valve with their own games or whatever that had this marketplace that they could push their games on. And as a small independent, like you didn't have access. So they came up with this scheme to make that happen, which was amazing. Everything changed in a year. So it went from a marketplace where we felt like we had a lot of viability and potential to sell. And I don't know the number of copies that we would have needed to break even, but let's call it 50,000. And I think to date now, I think we've sold like 25,000 or something like that, which is still a lot for an indie title.
I've shipped AAA titles that didn't sell.
But it didn't make money. It didn't make money because the ecosystem changed and it was flooded with so many titles.
Yeah, it's hard to stand out.
Now it's insane. The number of, like, how many titles launch on Steam in any given week? There are hundreds, thousands.
I don't know how anybody gets traction with that sort of...
It's insane. Yeah. Unless you have, like... six-figure plus marketing budget. Good luck.
Right,
it's crazy.
Yeah,
it's very similar to movies. You know, there's so much indie content coming out from indie films. It's hard to stand out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and you almost have, like you're saying, you almost have to. You got a budget for your marketing to be almost as much as what you spend on the production.
Yep.
Otherwise, you're never going to be seen.
Yep. Well, and I think what's fascinating about film and television too, and I feel the same way about games. And I don't know if you guys have this, but I have a backlog for every form of media that I consume. Doesn't matter if it's print, digital, if it's Netflix, if it's like an HBO, if it's video games, whatever. Like I've got a stack of video games.
So this is stuff you want to play, but you just never get around to.
Right. And I have access to, whether that's I've already purchased or is in my queue or on my watch list or whatever. These are all things at my fingertips.
It's just so much. Yeah.
The biggest commodity right now is time. Yeah. I don't have time to do any of this shit.
Like, you can't do all of it.
No.
So how do you stand out to get the attention of the audience?
Across all these forms of media, outside of maybe print, unfortunately, although it's getting filtered down to the best, there's more quality than ever.
Right.
Like with television, it's like, I don't even know how to catch up. This new show come out. Have you seen it? I'm like, no, man, I'm on this show from like 2 years ago.
I'm watching The Wire now.
I'm rewatching The Wire for the fifth time.
I don't know if you're like me, but I don't like watching too many. Like, if I start binge watching a series, I don't want to jump around between multiple series. I want to stick with until I'm done, and then I'll jump onto the next one.
So. Like even jumping to Westworld the other night felt unnatural because I'm an idiot and I'm so into The Wire right now. Yeah. I'm like, yes, like oh my god, it is amazing. Yeah. Again, it's even better.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, and I'm like, oh, I guess I'll watch Westworld just so I can talk about it at work or whatever. Which it's like, I love that series and it's so ridiculous that I feel that way.
What season of The Wire are you on?
I'm back to four.
Yeah, okay.
I think the middle of four.
Four is the season that Nick, our friend, is.
Our buddy's an extra. Yeah. A lot of our friends worked on The Wire. So.
Yeah.
Being in Baltimore.
It's the Be More Pride.
So let me ask this before we move on from the indie project, because I'm curious about this. And you don't need to name names, because this could get really sensitive.
Just name them. I'll be right now.
But was there a human cost in that? And I ask this because I've started studios before, actually. Mm. And some of them never took off, and some of them did. But you always start with a really passionate group of friends.
Yep.
And you know, you're going to get together and you're going to build the thing that you want. It's going to be awesome and we're going to eat dirt and do it.
Yep.
And once these problems get in and money gets involved and different opinions get involved, I've lost friends over the best of intentions. You know, I've had to fire friends before.
Man.
So what did you find with these guys that you did this with? Are you guys all still friends? Are you?
No. I mean, that happened to us too. I think everybody has their own relationships that they hold on to. And I'm definitely still really good friends with a couple of our founders. But, you know, shit got complicated, man. And money and friendship are a very difficult thing to mix.
Yeah.
And I will say, coming together to form your own company, creates really interesting power dynamics. And it's really, really tough to hold on to friendship when you're also struggling with, an enterprise that is directly tied to your financial viability as an individual, right?
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
It's fucking tough.
There's expectations. You know, what somebody thinks their value and worth is.
And
how you navigate that.
Right. Yeah. And what is the value of your game, right? Like, we all went into this not thinking, it wasn't like a get-rich-quick scheme. Like, we were like, oh my God, yeah, we're gonna scam Steam and fucking make $10 million. Like, there are games that have done that, and that's ridiculous. But we thought we're gonna have a really viable product. You know what I mean? It's like the whole pitch of like FTL meets Oregon Trail is fuck in 3D is awesome. I'm like, yeah, I'll play that game. That sounds great, right? But like, holy shit, man. Like, one, it didn't come together like that. And two, when it doesn't come together and the money isn't there, things can get tough, man. Like, when you're talking about, like, you know, I'd have partners calling me and be like, yo, man, like, am I going to be able to pay rent next month?
Right.
Like, that shit's real.
Yeah.
That's real tough. And like, even as a lead, you know, mid-level, low-level lead in the game industry, like, you're not having to worry about that kind of shit. You know what I mean? Like, you're like, yeah, no, it's, I don't know. Talk to HR. Like, oh, you need a raise? Like, man, like, I'll put in the good word, but I don't know. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Whereas when it's just you, that shit's really intimate and it's really hard. And I don't regret doing it. I think it was a fascinating journey, and I will say that I learned more in that condensed period than I ever would have thought possible in AAA. Just because you get to touch so much. You know, it just like goes back to my time on Day
of Defeat.
You're doing everything. You know what I mean? And you become an expert in all these different areas. And you rely on the people directly next to you to fill the same amount of areas, right? And it's fucking crazy. But it's magical at the same time. And I don't think I would be the leader that I am today without that experience.
Let's take a break real quick. We got another sponsor.
This bottle of Jameson is way too full. I'm looking at you. I need your help. Because if I drink all this and get on a 4 a.m. flight, I'm going to be really...
You got a flight tomorrow morning.
I got a flight.
Okay. Yeah, it's getting late, and Ben has a flight.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come back, and we'll start wrapping this up.
All right.
Hey, D3 Podcast listeners, Jeremy here. This episode is sponsored by... Well, we don't have any sponsors. This one's sponsored by you. We want to hear from you guys. Please get a hold of us. All of our contact information is at d3podcast.com. d3podcast@gmail.com. You can also email us at drinks@d3podcast.com. We want to hear your thoughts, your suggestions, your questions for our upcoming guests. You know, I'm going to be posting on our Reddit thread and on our Twitter who our next guests are going to be. And if you've got any questions for them specifically, I want to include them in that episode. So head on over there, check it out. If you've got any anything you want to ask, please let us know. And we'll try and get it on our next episode. So thanks so much for listening, guys. And let's get back to the show. All right. Did you want to do another shot?
No, I'm okay.
Okay, all right. We're back.
All right, yeah, back from break. So I had kind of to transition, like, how did you get out of the indie scene? Because I know, you know, we talked about, I don't know if people believe us on how emotionally invested we are in this. And I know,
yeah,
you know, I had a studio for THQ that I had a bunch of my friends involved in, and we had a good run. And it kind of imploded at the end, and you know, it was tough. I lost some of my friends. You know, one of my best friends that I started the studio with, we were just at odds. It was horrible. And it was right before you met me at Zipper. But I had to take a year off and just do nothing but drink and fish. I would have been completely worthless.
First of all, one, I wish I had made that revelation myself. And so, like, who the fuck is? He's like, you know, things have been really hard. I'm just gonna fish and drink for a year. Well, what are you, like, an artist? But, like, what is this bullshit?
I know, yeah, geez, that doesn't sound very programmery of me. But yeah, I cashed out all my savings, everything that I had in my bank account. I think that's good for your mental health.
No.
It was, but I mean, so what did you have coming out of this? Did you have some downtime, or did you jump into the next thing immediately, or how did you recover?
Yeah, let me say I'm mostly jealous because I definitely should have done that. I took a couple of weeks. Like, we were in Southern California, so I just went down to the beach for like 2 weeks and just chilled and tried to think about, reflect on everything that had happened.
Yeah.
But also kind of like think about the future. Like, what did I want to do? Right. Like, it was really interesting in that point in my career. I had done a lot, right? And certainly much more than I had ever anticipated when I got into game development, right? Mm-hmm. Like, coming out of the indie scene and like getting into AAA and working like on massive, massive IPs like SOCOM and Medal of Honor and Battlefield. Like, Battlefield is my favorite game ever. Like, right. To be able to work on that is fucking crazy. Like, that's a dream that anybody could have, right? It's just like, the kid is like, I love Call of Duty. Oh my God, it'd be amazing to work on Call of Duty. It's like, I got to do that. Like, that... Mm-hmm. I felt so lucky and fortunate, and I was really looking at it as like, all right, well, like, what else could I do? What else, like, if I want to stay in this industry, which is a big question, what do I actually want to do?
Yeah.
And you know, what I came back to is like, I want to lead a bigger team, like a bigger team than I led at DICE, and obviously bigger than like what I'd been driving in the indie scene. And, you know, that was the primary one. And then I kind of looked at the landscape, and I was talking to a bunch of different people, all working on really, really interesting shit. But I didn't really know what my role wanted to be. I knew I wanted to like head up a team in a certain way. And I didn't know if that was production or if it was like in creative or whatever. Cause at that point, especially coming out of a product that we had shipped with basically four people, I was like, yeah, I can do anything, whatever. Oh, you want me to run marketing? No problem. Like, you know, which is ridiculous because it's not that way, and it takes a team for sure. But like when you're an indie and you know you have mountains on your shoulders, like you definitely feel like you can do anything. So you know, I was really questioning that, and then I happened to stumble upon an interview at Daybreak in San Diego, and you know they had this product in H1Z1 that was really coming along.
Mm-hmm. Where was the game?
Well, so the game was still technically in quote-unquote early access, right? But it had really blown up because before Fortnite and before PUBG, there was this game called H1Z1, which was...
way back in 2015?
Like, yeah, 2 years ago was like the biggest Battle Royale game there was.
And that was a mod based on... was it... Not Arma.
PlayerUnknown, who ended up building PUBG, right, had built this mod for Arma.
Yeah.
And in the worst contract deal ever, we had brought him over to come and work on H1Z1. And he had been a very influential person on like building the evolution of the battle royale genre at that time in H1Z1. And there were some smart people at the studio at the time that pulled him in and said, like, all right, let's do this.
Him meaning
Brandon Green, the creator of the battle royale genre, right, in games, right? Yeah. So he came in and worked at Daybreak for a while on this thing, and maybe even at SOE at that time.
That's a Sony.
Sony Online Entertainment. Yeah, so that eventually became Daybreak. So anyway, H1Z1 was this really interesting property, and they brought in some really good people. They brought in like Chris Wynn, the producer, who'd come over from BioWare. And there was some really, really good PM talent that had come in from places like Zynga, like people that knew what they were doing, right? And I was like, okay, like I'll go talk. And everything that they were talking about was really fascinating, because this whole concept of games as a service had evolved greatly in the 2 years that since I had left DICE, right? Like where we were doing DLC and really trying to push forward a lot of things, and looking at options of Battlefield, like what is Battlefield as games as a service? We were thinking about these things, but very few people were actuating them. And H1Z1 was one of the properties outside of mobile, actually in the true quote unquote AAA space, that was doing these things. So I was fascinated, you know, I took this interview and everything that they said sounded really interesting. And they're like, look, we want to come, you know, you come in like as a creative and like help to make this product something great. And you know, when I got there, by the time I got hired, things had changed. They'd hired some more people. They were looking at different options and, you know, they're like, well, we want you to lead this subset of H1Z1 called Just Survive. And, you know, it's doing its thing, but it feels relegated and like the community has been left behind, in the wake of H1Z1, which was a massive hit at the time, right? Like making a shitload of money per day, hundreds of thousands of players. It was huge. And I, you know, the option was work on H1Z1 core product and like try to make that better, which already had a huge team and they, you know, established roadmap and everything. They knew what they were doing. And I'm almost like, all right, that's one thing. Or take over this, not fledgling, but, you know, just the product that had gotten left behind and try to make it into something bigger. Which is a daunting prospect, right? Because there's what the community wants, which is service this thing that we love and give us more stuff. And then there's the challenge that I've been given of make it bigger, make it better, and make it into something really interesting. So I, you know, I looked at that and said, okay, I'd never worked on a product that was in disrepair, right? That needed love. So I looked at that and said, wow, okay, that's my next challenge in this industry. That's something that can keep me going, because I have a clear goal, right? It's like take this thing that is small and fledgling and isn't getting any love and build it into something that could potentially be much bigger, right? Mm-hmm. So we took that challenge and, you know, we had a very small team and tried to do a lot of big things with a very small team, which anybody will tell you is a huge challenge. But again, coming from indie, I was like, yeah, fuck it. We can do this. Give me five people and I can turn the world on its axes, right? No problem. So that proved to be a lot harder than what we thought, but we did do some really, really interesting shit in the year that I was there. And man, it was crazy, right? Because H1Z1 is this huge thing and it's doing all this stuff and it's like sucking up all the resources and we're trying to just like be isolated and do our own thing. Yet there's this huge pressure to make it into something bigger. Right. Mm. So that was really interesting. I don't know how much I can talk about that because it's all super relevant, but I will say that, you know, I'm very, very proud of the team and what we were able to accomplish on that product given the challenges that we were faced. And, you know, I think the community came at us with very mixed reactions with what we tried to do, and deservedly so. Like, you know, I will say, like, we took some things away from them to try to build something bigger, and that's always hard. Mm-hmm. That's never something that you want to do. And if you're looking at development lessons, I will say that taking things away from people, regardless of platform or how successful the product is or anything else, is the hardest thing that you can do as a game designer, right? Because there are a lot of people that are used to that. And if you replace it
very,
with something...
Very vocal people.
And very vocal, right? Even if that's the vocal 1%, they're very vocal about what they want and what they love. And And it's tough, especially if your ultimate goal is to say, look, like, we want to grow this audience. And sometimes that goal is in direct interference with the existing audience. And you might lose them in order to try to gain something bigger. And that's a very, very difficult prospect. But we looked at that and said, look, like, that's a challenge worthy of pursuing. Because we've got a product that's been in early access for multiple years at this point, is relatively directionless, and we want to try to do something different. And we have the ability to do so. So we took it. So, yeah.
Well, so kind of talking about the ebb and flow of this industry. So we just got news today. I don't know when this is going to air. It'll probably air pretty soon. But we got news today of massive layoffs at that studio.
Yeah.
You know, taking a game that was just, you know, a few short months ago, huge in the industry, and now they're laying off, you know, tons of people.
Yeah.
How's everybody taking it? Do you have a feeling with that team?
I mean, I can't speak for everyone, and I no longer work there, right? So it feels a little weird. But I will say that it's pretty obvious that everyone's really disappointed. There was an interesting opportunity there. There was a moment in time where H1Z1 was the battle royale game, right? Mm-hmm. It was everything, and it was far from perfect.
No, but it was supported by all the streamers, right?
I mean, right. Everybody was on board. Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, it was a love-hate relationship.
Well,
right?
I guess that's true with every game, but yeah.
Yeah. But I think that the issue with H1Z1 is it was so early, right? And there was so much to do and so much to polish,
right,
that it had all this room to grow, and everybody knew where it needed to be in order to be really successful.
Sure.
And it was going to take a lot of work to get it there. And yet at the same time, it had developed into an incredibly successful property based upon what it was, right? So translating that into like something that was relatively janky, but the premise was super strong, right? And the pace of play was good, and people liked a lot of aspects of it. But there were a lot of things that were fundamentally broken about that product. And we knew where we needed to get it. It was an early access after all, right? But looking at that, I think it's relatively easy to see what happened, right? Where Brandon with PUBG and Epic with Fortnite looked at the example that was set and said, okay, cool, like, that's all great. We know exactly what works and we know how to do it better. We're going to do this on a different tech stack, a different engine, with a larger team, and put it together really quick, and we're going to be more competitive. And there are a lot of other things that I won't get into that happened there. But I will say that it's really disappointing when you're on a product that ends up being a stepping stone to what is the biggest game in gaming worldwide. Like, to the point where Fortnite is transcending boundaries, right? Is like the biggest. I could say that, like, maybe I'm wrong, but I think Fortnite is the biggest entertainment property in the world right now. I really think it's
incredibly huge.
Like, yeah. To the point where it's like, oh, cool, yeah, we'll do this cross stream between Ninja and Diplo and Drake on like a weekly basis, or like what? Like,
no, and the,
no one anticipated
and
that.
And the thing that just happened in Vegas with Ninja and right. How they broke Twitch records.
Yeah, again, yeah. Again, yeah. And again.
Again, yeah,
right. I mean, it's amazing what's happening, and honestly,
I mean, I think it's great, right? I mean,
it's phenomenal.
In a lot of ways, it's amazing. I mean, gaming is just growing and growing and growing.
No. It is awesome for our industry.
Yeah,
it is awesome for the battle royale genre. It's awesome for anyone who plays multiplayer games. Like, seeing this happen is great, because what will happen after that in terms of the energy and the money and the effort put into it by major publishers to pursue game modes or different designs or alternate approaches in order to create them into like massive, massive things and give you lots of different ways to play those is endless. And that is what's coming. I think that is incredibly exciting. The only thing that I'm really disappointed about is what ended up happening with H1Z1 and what happened today with a team that I know really, really busted their hump to try to compete and to make something really special. And the odds ended up being against them.
Yeah, yeah, it's tough. I don't think people realize how hard the guys making the games actually do take this. But let's end this on a positive note. I know you can't talk about Calamity.
Oh, I thought you were going to say end this on a Jameson shot. But yeah,
we'll end this on many,
right,
many Jameson shots.
All right.
One more swig.
For the dead homies today, yeah. at Daybreak.
Absolutely. Respect to everybody out there. And I know you'll all end in fantastic places because we've got great people. So
yeah. All right, so as we're hitting the bottle of Jameson, and I don't know if this is going to make video, but we forgot shot glasses.
Oh, yeah.
We're actually just drinking off the bottle of Jameson.
What Ryan is trying to tell you is he is technically not classy.
Yeah, in case he had any questions about that. But you can't talk about Calamity, where that's happening, or what that
Calamity
is.
Calamity being what you're working on now.
Yes, your new project. But
well, I think maybe in the future you could come back and talk about that.
Well, hopefully. Oh, yeah, yeah. Definitely. Yeah, definitely. Sure. But what's the future for Ben Jones at the high level? What's next? What's the next big challenge? What are you looking to do?
That's a great question. For me, it's really about taking the next step in terms of leadership, which has been the consistent thread over the last 5 years of my career is taking on bigger and bigger prospects in terms of leadership and trying to take disparate groups of developers and coalesce them into a really, really powerful union that can form a game that is not only successful in the short term, but also in the long term. I want to build a live service product that just sings, that people want to pick up and play every day. Mm-hmm. And it isn't about, it isn't about nickel and diming, or it isn't about, you know, some of the bullshit we're seeing with like loot crates and everything else that a lot of people are dealing with right now. Like, it's about giving you a quality gameplay experience at scale and leveraging every single aspect of my career in order to give you the best that I've got. So that's what I'm trying to do right now on a much bigger, broader scale.
I'd hire you. That sounds pretty positive.
Well, in 2 to 5 years, 2 to 10 years, I don't know what it's going to be, but
this is a 27-year development process.
Who knows how long it's going to take? But hopefully, whoever's listening to this could say they heard of Ben Jones here first, and hopefully that's going to make you the famous game designer that you deserve to be. Let's end this on some advice to the younger generation that's trying to get in, for kids who are listening to this or people who are inspired by games and mm-hmm. want to get into the industry. What bit of advice would you have for them to come in and take over what the hell we do when we're finally fed up enough to retire?
Or come in now and I'll hire you. Focus on your passion. Absolutely. Like, whatever is driving you to get into this industry, whether it's art, whether it's design, whether it's UI, UX, whether it's monetization, whether it's producing, publishing, whatever it is, like, focus on that and seek your skill, right? Like, where do you feel like you can make your mark and differentiate yourself in the marketplace? I would definitely focus on that and say, okay, I'm going to strive towards this. And then look at all the avenues that support that, right? Whether that's the newfound educational opportunities, right? Like mm-hmm. All the different graduate schools or undergraduate programs focused on game design. Whether that's working on a mod that's out there right now that you can get your fingertips on. One that's been around forever, or the new greatest thing, whatever it is. Whether that's building your own game, right? There's a ton of different tool sets out there, including Unreal, that you can pick up for free and start experimenting with. There are endless tutorials. I would say it doesn't matter if you've decided that I want to be a game developer, or you've been in the industry for 30 years. If you're not tinkering, you're dying. So play around with things, figure it out, like, for yourself, and find something that you can leverage into a job.
I'd say that's pretty good advice. Well, Ben, thank you.
Thank you so much, Ben, for joining us.
A shout out to Scotty Wagner, our audio tech, actually just walked in.
Yeah, he's been working hard.
He was instrumental in getting our audio set up here at the studio working. So he just walked in. We're going to go have some beers with him, probably polish off this bottle of Jameson and see what's next. But Ben, thank you for coming out. Have a very good flight in the morning. I know it's pretty close.
It's going to be awesome. Can I have whatever's left of the Jameson?
That is all yours.
Oh, great.
It's here for you.
That's my carry-on.
But good luck on Calamity, and we'll get you back here.
We hope to have you back again. Yeah. Thank you so much.
So, Jeremy, why don't you wrap us up?
That's it. Thanks for listening to D3 Podcast. Visit our website, d3podcast.com. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, the Facebooks, all that good stuff. And we'll see you next time. Thanks so much. We'll be right back.